Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Yesterday, we mentioned the results of the parental revote in Miami-Dade County, the turnover of that school board at the last election with a little bit of air support from Ron DeSantis, and how they have reversed course. Last year, it was a overwhelming majority on the board that instituted LGBTQ plus History Month for October. And this year, it's an overwhelming majority that says, no, we're not doing that again. Parental revote locally. DG,
oh, yeah.
Downers Grove, and Drag Queen Story Hour.
Drag Queen Bingo.
The library, for the safety of everyone involved, the difficult decision has been made to cancel the upcoming Drag Queen Bingo due to threats made against the Downers Grove Public Library. The threats are currently under active investigation by law enforcement. Providing an inclusive, welcoming, blah, 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 to all the teens who blah, 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 blah. Thank you, everyone who sent us messages, blah, 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 blah.
We'll have a future event to support LGBTQ, blah, 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 teens.
People FOIA the Downers Grove Police Department to find out about these alleged threats.
And?
Seems like there was one sort of obtuse statement made by an out-of-state dude about bringing weapons, and that wasn't clear to the police if it was referring to Drag Queen Bingo event or just the town trustee board meeting. Someone else posted a page calling for false DCFS reports to the event.
Oh.
This is from the police report. So, right. Threats is what caused you to cancel these sort of generic threats, you know, pouring through social media accounts to look for something that was intemperate, even if it was perhaps sarcastic, so that you could hang your hat on. We're canceling it because of threats, not because this is a rejection of community values. No, never. Because this is the Downers Grove Public Library, because these are the elders of the community. So never would their judgment run afoul of the mores in the community in which they reside, the community they lead. No, of course not. This has to be a cancellation because we're under threat from MAGA extremists, which, of course, is always the default position. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro.
Yeah, I want to know what people think really happened. Channel 7, the event was canceled after cascade of threats. I mean, the drama here. Well, where's the proof? They didn't say any threats that were made. They're just saying that they're allegedly being investigated by police.
I'm incredibly disheartened to hear the Downers Grove Public Library is canceling their upcoming event. I'm sure he is, Sean Kasten. I'm sure he was looking forward to Drag Queen Bingo, bringing out some of his best undergarments to participate. And he blames Keith Peacock in Awake, Illinois. They created an unsafe environment in our community. They should be ashamed of themselves. They have used their platform to promote hatred, homophobia, and bigotry. This is the whole thing. This is the entire campaign of the left this year and every year every year up until the time there is a wholesale rejection and they understand it is not politically viable to play this we're good and they're bad, we're kind and they're mean grade school politics. But that's what they do now. The event was canceled, writes Congressman Sean Casten, who spends most of his time, speaking of threatening and derision and unkindness on social media, ridiculing people on social media. Let's be clear. The event was canceled because after my Republican opponent and his far-right allies at Awake Illinois publicly issued a call to action to their supporters, the library received severe threats that endanger our community. The 6th District is a place for kindness, love, and decency. Oh, hate has no home here.
Oh,
they literally talk like this. This is how people like Sean Casten talk. There is no brain there. There's just can't where a brain is supposed to be. There's just refrigerator magnet phrases that you see in people's yards that they repeat actually in conversation. Hate has no home here. The fact that Keith Peacock disagrees shows he has no place in public office.
He's so condescending, too.
Yeah. Ugh. Resign! I mean, he's like a bad Keith Olbermann impersonation.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I mean, they alleged that the event was sold out, but it was sexually deviant in nature. And if you looked at what this...
deviant. That sounds like hate words.
But Aurora, if you looked at Aurora's Instagram and Facebook page before she took it down, when you get bingo, you got to go up on stage and you get down on all fours and they have a big paddle that says bingo and she delights in the fact that she smacks you on the buttocks.
Aurora is one of these male impersonators.
Yeah, I'm sorry. She's
female
the dancer. She's the bingo
and
cross-dresser drag queen that does the event.
Yeah.
I mean, what were they going to do, slap kids on the buttocks when they got bingo? Or were they going to change it for the kids? Because this was, you know, sexual in nature and it doesn't belong in a taxpayer-funded setting or even at a library. I mean, weren't libraries supposed to be quiet places instead of, you know, they're going to play Katy Perry's Rainbow Song and dance? And
I got an idea for Sean Casten. If so committed to it, host at a local hotel. That's what the LGBTQIA plus Lavender Bund members in Buffalo Grove are doing. Buffalo Grove, Friday, October 7th, National Coming Out Day celebration. That's at the Doubletree by Hilton in Mundelein. Family-friendly dinner dance, art projects, and balloon twister, rainbow raffle, drag performances, photo ops.
Photo ops.
I'm sure they'd welcome Sean Casten to offer his wares at that event, and he should live his values and host an event, private, funded by him personally, to make sure that the 6th District remains the place that he says it is. And let's put that to the voters on November 8th and see what the 6th District, what the 6th District's social mores really are. How about that? And by the way, I'm not sure what they are, but let's put it to the test. Tony in Downers Grove.
Hey, Dan. Yep. A few weeks ago, I was sitting at one of my favorite places talking to a few people, and we were talking about this very thing, about the drag queen bingo. They were up in arms. So maybe there's some hope because they were talking about how they were really getting the word out and people were coming together. So maybe there's hope in Downers Grove. There could be. You never know. The other thing about the threats, that was almost 2.5 weeks ago this came out where they said, in fact, they had said there was a gun threat on Facebook. But then you didn't hear anything after that. I have and can I ask a question off topic, please?
Okay.
I was just listening before you guys came on the air. They had those ads against Tim Michaels in Wisconsin about how he's against abortion, even with rape and incest. And I was researching it. That's not factual. Yet they're running commercials that are painting him this way. So how do you, even your station's running these commercials, how do they combat this? That's my question. How do people run and combat
their own
disingenuous ads?
Thanks for the call, Tony. Well, I mean, in terms of that quickly, you run your own at number one, or number two, if you can substantiate that the claim is materially false, then you provide that proof to the stations that are airing the ads and you ask for a cease and desist. That's how you do it. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Hey, good morning, Ann. Good morning, Amy. I think the reason why they canceled this is the community finally realized this is really not a good thing to do to the kids, and they're using threats to save face. That's what I think about that. Have a good day.
I think you're over the target, Rich. Thanks for the call.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Insight into what it means and the sharpest opinion. There's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and this is in your wheelhouse, girls volleyball, Amy.
This incident very well aware.
BYU and Duke girls volleyball teams squaring off against one another. Out west, and a sophomore on the Duke volleyball team, who is black, said that she was subjected to racial slurs, racial jeers of a racial nature during the match against BYU. This led to a outcry from the left in the sports press corps, the left in the D.C. press corps. What's the difference?
Yeah, the black player from Duke, mostly predominantly white Mormon, BYU. This is atrocious. This shouldn't be happening. It's 2022. But did it ever even really happen?
What's the kind of go-to when it comes to these charges of racial-oriented crimes? You know, I mean, our friend Will Riley wrote a book about it, about the race hoax. And as long as there is demand, and there is great demand on the left to cry racism, they will create the supply. Thus, so many race hoaxes of the Jussie Smollett variety. Well, BYU looked into this. We reached out to more than 50 individuals who attended the event, Duke Athletic Department personnel and student-athletes, BYU Athletic Department personnel and student-athletes, event security management, and fans who were in the arena that evening, including many of the fans in the on-court student section, looked at all available video and audio recordings, including security footage and raw footage from all camera angles taken by BYU TV of the match, with broadcasting audio removed to ensure that the noise from the stands could be heard more clearly. We also so they did all this as part of their investigation into this allegation, while in the meantime, all of those who enjoy a good race hustle are hyperventilating on TV and elsewhere. The Stephen A. Smiths of the world and ESPN charging BYU with dereliction of duty. I'm saying, BYU, you did it by allowing this to happen and not addressing it expeditiously, not addressing it with a level of quickness and speed you should have addressed this with. Jim Acosta, Allison Camerata. Oh, yeah. From our extensive review going back to BYU, we have not found any evidence to corroborate the allegation that fans engaged in racial heckling or uttered racial slurs at the event. As we stated earlier, we would not tolerate any conduct that would make a student athlete feel unsafe. And so that's the upshot. Oh, by the way, that sprightly eunuch Republican governor they have in Utah, Spencer Cox, he threw in too. Everybody has to make sure that everyone knows they're against racism. Courageous. The Dawn Staley, who's the women's basketball coach of South Carolina.
Yeah.
She canceled a home-and-home series with BYU because of the alleged incident.
Oh, come on.
Also lauded as a hero for doing that. What's so heroic? So what do we have?
We have another Jesse Smollett case. We have this sophomore. Her name's Rachel Richardson, outside hitter, 5'9". She's from Maryland.
Yeah, thanks for stats. Or, well, height's important in this.
Well, 5'9", that's pretty short. That means she must be able to jump high for an outside hitter. That's good that she earned that spot on that team as a sophomore, as a starter. But she made up the story. That's what it looks like to everybody. She just made it up, just like Mattress Girl, remember, who carried around a mattress with her because she said she got sexually assaulted by somebody, and she carried with her the mattress where the alleged sexual assault happened, and it didn't happen, and the Phi Psi fraternity was taken down for that, and nothing ever happened. These are made up. These are people who, they need help. There's something wrong with them where they have this void in their life that they need to lie and make up a racial incident. To do what, I mean, to get attention, who knows what the reason is. I mean, for Jussie Smollett, it was because he wanted a bigger contract. For her, I don't know what it was.
Oh, it's so much deeper than that. It's so much deeper than, like, narrow pecuniary interest. That's just one of the benefits that's attendant to this. This is the response from Duke's athletic director after BYU found no evidence to substantiate the players' claim. The 18 members of the Duke community volleyball team are exceptionally strong women who represent themselves, their families, and Duke University with the utmost integrity. We unequivocally stand with and champion them, especially when their character is called into question. Duke Athletics believes in respect, quality, and inclusiveness, and we do not tolerate hate and bias. Oh, thank you for your statement of first principles, to the extent that principles are discernible in that gobbledygook you just vomited up. But what does that have to do with BYU's finding? BYU didn't call anybody's character into question. They investigated an allegation and found no evidence to support the allegation.
Yeah, she claims she was, you know, people are made multiple racial slurs while she was playing in a game.
Here's what she said about it too. The sophomore who made the allegations. Mm-hmm. Although the heckling eventually took a mental toll on me, I refused to allow it to stop me from doing what I love to do, what I came to BYU to do, which was to play volleyball. I refused to allow those racist bigots to feel any degree of satisfaction from thinking that their comments had gotten to me, so I pushed through and finished the game. Wow. I mean, it. Now, you know, she must have had some sense of what Hank Aaron went through. Therefore, on behalf of my, she continued, of course she did. Therefore, on behalf of my African-American teammates and I, we do not want to receive pity or to be looked on as helpless. No. We do not feel as though we are victims of some tragic, unavoidable event. We're proud to be young African-American women. We're proud to be Duke student athletes. And we're proud to stand up against racism. Yeah. Well, what racism were you standing up against exactly? I know what you claimed and how you heroically overcame what you claimed occurred. And yet 50 people in that section and all the tape and video. And if this was the heckling eventually took a mental toll on me. So this sounds like it was, she's saying it was like Robin Vickers style. Heckling. It just like was relentless all game long. And yet nobody can identify. There's none of it shows up on any of the video or audio. Uh-huh.
And yeah. She lied to her dad, and her dad went on CNN with Breonna Keeler and talked about, you know, the phone call he got after the game, and she was crying and something was wrong. This was a different kind of call. And she went on to describe to her father what happened, and I don't know. I mean,
well, her dad's not saying she lied.
No. But I'm saying that, well, the story is made up. And she called. I mean, heckling goes on in volleyball. But racial slurs, that's different. And the racial slurs, they found out, did not happen.
BYU women's volleyball coach Heather Olmstead reached out to Richardson to apologize. Why?
Why?
I mean, you know, this is Duke, right?
Oh, Duke.
You would think that they would have some sensitivity to racial hoaxes. You would think that they would have some restraint and not rush to judgment after the lacrosse case.
Oh, that's right.
But no. No. This is, you know, we were talking about the drag queen story hour, drag queen bingo business in Downers Grove in the suburbs. Now we're talking about the race hustle, the race hoaxes that are always at the red, that the left is always at the ready to create. And then, you know, the feeding frenzy that ensues right behind them. This is what the term cultural genocide means. I mean, these are illustrations of it. So the phrase cultural genocide is attributed to a Polish lawyer named Raphael Lemkin from the early part of the 20th century. Here's what he described in terms of defining cultural genocide. Generally speaking, genocide does not necessarily mean the immediate destruction of a nation. It's intended rather to signify a coordinated plan of different actions aiming at the destruction of essential foundations of the life of national groups with the aim of annihilating the groups themselves. The objectives of such a plan would be disintegration of the political and social institutions, of culture, language, national feelings, religion, the economic existence of national groups, and the destruction of personal liberty, personal security, I should say, liberty, health, dignity, and even the lives of the individuals belonging to such groups. Genocide is, he continued, genocide is barbarity, conceived as oppressive and destructive acts directed against individuals as members of a national, religious, or racial group, and the crime of vandalism conceived as malicious destruction of works of arts and culture because they represent the specific creations of the genius of such groups. So we understand genocide in the context of Armenia, obviously in the context of the Holocaust. We don't, I think, have an appreciation for what cultural genocide is. This phrase that Raphael Lemkin came up with, and I think is he nicely developed, because what he defines as cultural genocide, that's what's happening in this country at the hands of the left. And the topics from the last two segments, the racial hoaxes and hustles, the annihilation of the differences between the sexes, the sexualization of children, that's what cultural genocide is. That's how it occurs. Coordinated plan of different actions aiming at the destruction of the essential foundations of the life of national groups with the aim of annihilating the groups themselves. Disintegration of political and social institutions, of culture, language, national feelings, religion, the economic existence of national groups. The destruction of personal security. Tell me that's not happening at the hands of the identitarians. Tim in Woodstock on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, one thing that struck me is why did, if this was true, why didn't she say something to a referee or a coach? I mean, are you kidding me? If you have a group of fans that are hurling these insults at you, racial slurs, I really find it hard to believe nothing would be said.
Nobody heard it. Nobody heard it. If you were playing opposite her on the BYU team, maybe this assumes like the BYU women's team is just a bunch of white supremacists. You think BYU women would say nothing or would not say, yeah, this fan? By the way, there was one fan who's not a BYU student who was banned, and that ban on him has now been rescinded because there's no evidence to support the claim that he made any of these racial slurs. So she's on a court. She's next to her teammates. She's right across the net from BYU. You've got a referee. You've got other people in this section that the fans from, you know, which from whence the slurs were allegedly coming. And nobody hears it except her, even though it was clearly sustained. She alleges the way she describes this as having to power through the slurs over the course of the game or the match.
Yeah, really. I mean, in this day and age, if something like that had really happened, the game would be stopped. Someone would be going up in there, and you'd have security going up in there in this day and age. I mean,
no, they kicked them out. Well, I've stopped two games. I'm not going to name the schools, but one, they were making fun, or it was against our boys, or making fun of my Asian player, saying things that I've never even heard before. And I said, time out. And I just talked to the ref. I said, that player right there, because you can hear him. It was disgusting. So the security went, they took him out, he was gone. And then another time we played another school, and it was just disgusting what was going on. They were making horrible comments about my girls' body parts. Stopped the game, got them kicked out. And because you go to some games, and it's deafening. You can't even hear. I mean, it's hard to call plays, and then there's other games where nobody's there. But if somebody was yelling racial slurs like that, a player would have stopped. A referee definitely would have stopped it. And the coaches, I believe, would definitely have called a timeout and stopped it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
Dan and Amy, top of the morning. I want to warn you about what you're next going to hear. It's even more traumatizing if you see it. And, you know, I'm not one who's easily made queasy. I'm not afraid of anything, but this exchange has prevented me from sleeping at night.
Okay. Oh, what is it?
I'm afraid to close my eyes.
Dan, the tease is killing me. The suspense is killing me. What is it?
Uh-oh. It's Hillary Clinton and Chelsea Clinton and Megan Thee Stallion having a chat while painting with watercolors.
Chelsea follows rap music. She has ever since she was a little girl.
Oh, yeah,
but I kind of came to awareness of you with the Cardi B WAP.
I've always wanted to do a song with Cardi. As soon as she sent me the song, I think I sent it back to her like the next day. And it was just so exciting. The men, they seem so confident in what they're saying, and they don't have no problem with talking about their sexuality and how they're gonna have sex with you. So I was like, well, I could do that, and it's gonna sound fire coming from a woman.
It's great to see women be so kind of fierce.
That is my life's mission, to make sure that I'm always unapologetically me.
I mean, it just curdles your blood. So,
are they do the mom and daughter have some new show? Some new, what are they doing?
Talking about their wet ass private parts with Megan Thee Stallion. So that's what I want you to think about for the rest of the day. Hillary Clinton and how she came
that.
To know about Megan Thee Stallion, because she's a big rap fan generally and specifically of WAP.
Okay.
Horrifying.
Okay, take a deep breath. We're going to reset.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know Governor Spaulding wants to obsess about the commercials and other material that the PAC I run is putting out into the public domain for consideration by the electorate in advance of, well, in advance of early voting, which starts in about 5 minutes, and in advance of the November 8th election. Yeah, so I just want to put some more out there, despite the criticism I know that will come to me and anybody I point to saying something similar to what I'm saying, as fear-mongering. Racist.
Racist. They don't care about the victim.
Everything is fear-mongering and racism with these people because, well, I mean, it's not like they can defend the substance of what they've done, so they got to attack your opponent. It's pretty standard. Jay Hanley is the state's attorney in Winnebago County, out Rockford way. He has an op-ed in the Rockford Register Star in which he writes, among other things, on January 1st, it's estimated more than half of the inmates in the Winnebago County Jail will walk out the door. Approximately 400 criminal defendants will be released back into our community because our Illinois legislators passed the Safety Act. There are numerous issues with the new law, writes yet another county prosecutor, Jay Hanley, Winnebago County. Numerous issues with the new law, perhaps most problematic is that it only allows for even the possibility of pretrial detention for a small subset of crimes and under very limited circumstances, regardless of the defendant's risk to reoffend or their known danger to the community. There you go again for those, oh, yeah, it's still judicial discretion. No, no, no. The Illinois Supreme Court, going back to Mr. Hanley, the state's attorney, the Illinois Supreme Court has held that when determining bail, a judge's decision must balance the right of the accused to be free on bail against the right of the general public to receive reasonable protective consideration by the courts. The Safety Act, however, for emphasis, does away with all of that. It strips judges of their important role and responsibility to both defendants and the public by actively preventing them from considering each case on its own merits and applying the law accordingly. Under the Safety Act, entire categories of crime, such as aggravated batteries, robberies, burglaries, hate crimes, aggravated DUIs, vehicular homicide, drug-induced homicides, all drug offenses, including delivery of fentanyl and trafficking cases, not eligible for detention, no matter the severity of the crime or the defendant's risk to a person or the community. The bottom line, writes Jay Hanley, the Winnebago County State's Attorney, the law will allow dangerous individuals to roam our streets. It will deter victims and witnesses from reporting crimes, and it will make it more difficult to prosecute those alleged crimes. I can't be put in more plain fashion. The law will allow dangerous individuals to roam our streets. It will deter victims and witnesses from reporting crimes, and it will make it more difficult to prosecute those alleged crimes. So now the left, led by Spaulding and Triple Threat, can continue on with their, I'm a racist, Jay Hanley's a racist, everybody else who opposes what they're doing is a fearmonger if they're not also a racist. Go ahead. Go ahead, as he did again yesterday.
Yeah, because somebody asked about the commercial that ran during the Bears game. You know, everyone, they didn't know about this before because their heads, they've been living under a rock. But, yeah, ask about the commercial.
Look, it's terrible. It's a terrible commercial. They've chosen a particular crime in which there was a white woman who is the victim and apparently black perpetrators. That's the ad they want people to see, particularly in the suburbs. That's part of the entire racial tinge of everything that's being put out by that pack. And let's also take note, at least this morning, I think I read.
And I'm actually so stupid. When he said, look, it's terrible, I thought he would follow with what happened to that woman. But instead, he said that. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
The race of the victim in that beating and robbery in Lakeview That's what the most important thing is to the governor, the race, not what happened to her.
No, not what, no. He has zero sympathy or empathy for that victim. Because my follow-up was, well, what about the victim? Are you, hello? Walks away. Sickening. That says a lot about him as a man and as a governor.
By the way, I did the spot. I can't make out the race or races of the three perpetrators on the video.
Oh, I said that to a reporter. He's like, no, you know they're black, Amy. And I said, I don't know. They could be Hispanic. So, I can't tell. I can't tell with that grainy video.
I can't make them out.
I can make out her race.
I can't make out the race or races of the perpetrators video. Yeah.
She could be Hispanic.
The women is a little more obvious. So the governor either has racial x-ray vision or he just wants the attackers to be black. Well, why would he want that?
Because he wants to call you and Darren Bailey racist.
I think it's disgusting, and I've said that before. I think, you know, we ought to be running this on the, you want to talk about crime? Let's talk about crime. Oh, Darren Bailey sanctions these kinds of ads, thinks they're okay, has accepted the support of that PAC. And Darren Bailey is the one who voted to defund police.
Well, Darren Bailey said no. He hasn't even seen the ad yet.
This is an election year ploy. I think people are going to see this and understand this.
Because he doesn't approve whether or not what ads your super PAC runs.
We are talking about crime. Pritzker said, you want to talk about crime? Let's talk about crime. We are talking about crime. We're talking about the Safety Act. That's what everybody's talking about. Now everybody knows something that you and your party didn't want them to know, which is why you passed it in the dark of night in a lame duck session without any sort of substantial extended engagement by the actual stakeholders in our justice system, for the people, first and foremost, but in addition, the professionals, the judges, the prosecutors, the police. And so we are everybody's talking about crime now. They're talking about the substance of the legislation and what its implications will be for their communities, particularly as they see the way that you, Governor, and your friends are running Chicago and Cook County. That's what's actually happening. Since he cannot deal on that, because since he will not respond to James Glasgow or Bob Berlin or Jay Hanley or many other county sheriffs and prosecutors, he uses the convenience of a jarring ad to play the race hustle, because that's what he does. That's what Lightfoot does. That's what the left does. That's all they have. And so, but I still want to deconstruct the allegation here with respect to this recent ad. The white victim and apparently black perpetrators. Again, I don't know what the race of the attackers individually or collectively, if they're the same or what, the same race or not.
Well, you didn't choose it because they were black.
I don't care. Because race is not the factor in deciding whether to acknowledge somebody who's been victimized or to reckon with somebody who has committed a violent act, is it?
I mean, this is our reality, and he doesn't live in our reality. He has bodyguards all the time protecting him, whereas a woman, an innocent lady, just walking down the street on a nice sunny Sunday afternoon, gets bum-rushed, slammed to the ground. Her life is going to be changed forever. They take some stuff from her, and they drive away. I'm like, leave her there. I don't care. That's the mentality on the streets right now, and that's the fear that people are living with. And what, you know, it scared people. Like, oh, that was so upsetting. Somebody told me yesterday I was so upset I couldn't sleep the night before.
It is upset.
Should be upsetting. Right. You should be upset. That shows that you're a compassionate, caring human being when you see somebody being, you know, beaten up like that.
And you should be further upset that the governor wants you to focus on the race of victim and perpetrator rather than on the behavior of the perpetrators. And then the reckoning or the lack thereof the perpetrators get from our justice system. That's what is germane.
And I think here's more about the suspects than the victim.
How many times have we talked about the victims on this show? We talk about the victims all the time. We make mention of the fact that, oh, by the way, something that is never discussed by the left. 80% of the victims of violent crime north of it particularly murders and shootings in Chicago, are black. So the allegation, we focus on, you know, black people who commit acts of crime, and it's disproportional to their population. So are black victims disproportionate to their population? I'm interested in the victims, and I'm interested in a reckoning for the perpetrators. It's pretty straightforward. I think that's where most people are. Unfortunately, you have a governor and a mayor that are interested only in the particular predators or particular victims contingent on their race. If it's black on white, eh. If it's black on black, eh. If it's white on black, I'm interested. Tell me more. And that's about it.
I'm telling you, those three suspects, you know they watch the Bears game. You know they watch football. And it aired all day Sunday on a number of different networks during a number of different football games. Somebody knows who those three are, and I bet your campaign ad is going to help police catch those thugs that did that to her.
Something else.
They're still on the loose. I check every day.
Something else he said, too, well, particularly in the suburbs, this is echoing the Lightfoot line, that this is, you know, some messaging for the lily white suburbs. Suburbs aren't lily white, number one. Number two, this ad, like the previous ad, and like more to come. So, hey, governor, mayor, keep playing the race card. Keep going with your race hustle. Keep doing it. I implore you. Be who you are. Those ads are going statewide, including in Chicago, and including on digital platforms. This is not something where these ads are being targeted to Winnetka and Hinsdale. No. No. I want everyone to see it. Everyone. I want families on the west side and the western suburbs, the south side and southern Illinois. I want everyone to see how these politicians have laid waste to your state. I'm happy to make the arguments. I'm happy to have that conversation on crime. We're having it. You should join, Governor. No. He can stand at a podium, throw out the race card, walk away. That's his having a conversation on crime. And same goes for his little buddy, Lightfoot. Kurt in Brookfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I've got 29 years, and I've got 29 years in law enforcement, and I'm at the end of my career. And I just can't believe how these politicians, especially the governor and the mayor, who have these massive protection details, that they don't have to worry about the crime. It's my brothers and sisters out there on the street that I feel sorry for. The morale is just going to an all-time low, especially when you see bills like this being passed. And most of all, when law enforcement goes out, we don't see black-on-white crime, white-on-black crime, black-on-black crime. We see crime, criminals, and victims. We're there to try to serve the people. And this governor and mayor does everything to try to separate the people. It's so disgusting to end my career and see what these people are doing. I put my life on the line along with fellow officers all the time for nothing, for these clowns. For him not to even address crime, to want to address the politics of it, it's just unbelievable that this country's going down the toilet because they don't care about the people that serve the communities to protect them or the people themselves, no matter what community. If I was in the African-American community, I'd be uproared about the lack of help I am getting. No one cares. It's disgusting. Thank you for doing what you're doing.
Thanks for the call, Kurt.
Thank you, Kurt. And thanks for your service, too, and your career.
Gabby Schomburg.
Hi, good morning, guys. Pardon my morning voice. this is going to breed more criminality. When I came home from work yesterday, first of all, everybody at work is talking about it. We got to get out. I got to get a gun. I got to arm myself, my family, et cetera. My husband and I are sitting here getting a game plan down on how we're going to grocery shop, how, where and when we're going to go to places. Okay, honey, I'll drive. You have the gun. Well, you have a FOIA card. Debbie, you need to go and get a concealed carry. I sat and thought, I go, why should I go through all that expense? I'll just go to the range, learn how to point and shoot. At this point, why should I go through the expense and be a law-abiding citizen when I have criminality all around me? And they're okay with criminality. With our Constitution, with the laws of this country, why should I be a sucker and go through the time and expense? And I'm just saying, is going to breed more criminality. And that's it. Very sad. Have a good day.
Thanks, Gabby. Steve Roselle.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thank you for getting the word out, because when I tell people that there will be no bond in the new year, they think it's a good year. They think it's a good thing because they're thinking that no bond will be permitted. Actually, it's no bond will be required.
Yeah, right. big difference. They're going released. Yes. Thanks for the call, Steve. Peter Downers Grove.
Hey, good morning. So I don't know if you already have this in the works or not, but suggestion for a commercial would be to show the timeline of the Safety Act from when it was when they changed the number on it to when it was voted on, who voted on it, and I think you might be able to get 30 seconds out of it.
Well, and better question is what Democrat legislator voted against it? Because every Democratic state rep and state senator that I know voted for it. There's got to be some downstate, but we got to look through that.
We've got the roll call votes. Okay. I think there are a couple of downstaters. But, yeah, no, all of those suburbanites.
Oh, yeah. They all voted for it.
By the way, related story, Danny Golden, the officer who was shot and paralyzed on the South Side.
Yes, yeah.
I just want to make this note. This coming Sunday, 3 p.m., Riley's daughter, there's a barbecue. 100% of the proceeds are going to, you know, him and his medical expenses. Danny Golden, barbecue, Riley's daughter on the South Side, you know, 111th Street.
We
400
know
block of 111th Street. I'm sure you know it. But
I'm sure you know it,
well, maybe
too.
Maybe some others there are not familiar.
It's a great
Riley's venue. Daughter, 4010 West 111th Street, Danny's barbecue this Sunday, 3 p.m., it's like $20 for a barbecue buffet, $20 t-shirts available and stuff too. If you want to kibitz among people who actually believe in, you know, the rule of law. You know, antiquated concepts like that. Larry Elmhurst.
Hey, good morning. Hey, Dan, if the Sox make the playoffs this year, you should play that commercial every game. And after January 1st, if this, you know, all this crime starts taking place, I'll have my phone on. If somebody breaks into my house, I'll videotape me blasting them.
Okay. All right, Larry. I'm glad you're prepared. Leave Larry alone. Criminal element.
You've been warned. Your dad.
Frank Arlington Heights.
Playoffs? Playoffs? Those Sox ain't making the playoffs. No. I'm sorry.
Nice Jim Mora impersonation, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah, it was weak. But how you doing? This would be quite an embarrassment for J.B. Pritzker among his Brahmin rich people cast.
Yeah.
For a hotel magnate like him to lose to a mere farmer like Darren Bailey. And he's running scared. This is the issue that could turn the state like Virginia, just like they had the school issues in Virginia that propelled Youngkin to victory. The Safety Act is the manifestly stupid piece of legislation that the Democrats passed in the middle of the night, and it's the thing that could destroy them. It could be their act of hubris.
Well, the Black Caucus wanted it, right? And they pushed him to do it, and now he's like, uh-oh, people are fighting back. Even black people are fighting back. Even Democrats are fighting back.
Bill in LaSalle County.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Dan, can the news stations or the TV stations or radio stations actually refuse to take your advertising as like a censorship?
They can refuse to take it. Thanks for the call, Bill.
They played it on their air.
It's complicated. I mean, some, like Cox Media, they refuse to air anything that has acts of violence, sort of categorically. So they didn't run my previous spot, Summer of Joy spot, that leads in with Lori Lightfoot declaring this summer the Summer of Joy, and then goes through what's actually happened, introduces the Safety Act, and introduces comments from Glasgow and Berlin, the two suburban prosecutors. They wouldn't play that, and they won't play the Scream. So some digital platforms are tough. Facebook is terrible. YouTube is difficult. But And then sometimes, depending, you know, you have to deal with corporate legal departments a lot of times when you're talking about ad placement. Even if it's the affiliates in a place like Chicago, you're talking to their general counsel in New Jersey, which I have. And by the way, it's not enjoyable. But so you have to substantiate the ad. And I think from my experience that conservatives are held to a higher standard than the left because, I mean, you're talking about broadcast outlets, you're talking about TV networks, you're talking about mainly positions that are occupied by the left. And so they put you through the ringer in a way they don't their fellow travelers. I think that's just the fact. But for the most part, they'll run the ads because, especially at the local level, you know, they want the money. So that's the good news. You know, the appeal to their desire to make money, starting with the sales agent that interacts with the client, and then going up through the general sales manager, and you know, we have the same thing here at the station, and then on up to corporate and so on and so forth.
What has been the most difficult station to work for, or to try to work with, I should say, or you know?
Well, Facebook is the worst.
Facebook
is the worst. ABC7 corporate is bad because of their general counsel. WGN has been a little jumpy. I mean, some of the other networks have been fine. They've been professional. But yeah, I mean, it's just like I just come up with anything, or anybody can just come up with anything and they'll throw it on the air for you if you've got the money. It's a little bit more complicated than that. And every line in my ads has substantiation. And I've been doing it, you know, this on and off for a long time. So I have a pretty good idea how it's done, which is why I find the generic attacks from a Pritzker or a Lightfoot about, you know, that you're just personal to me, I'm a racist, I'm this, I'm that, sort of comical, because they know they can't attack the particulars. It's very much like the newspapers. They can't attack the particulars because you just say, well, to point to one thing that is inaccurate or untrue. Well, they can't, so they just say, well, you're a racist because look what you did. You're racist because that's a white victim, and I think those are black perpetrators. I'm just going to assume they are for the purposes of my claim of racism. That's how they do it. So that's the environment in which we're operating. And, you know, it presents a lot of challenges for Republicans, conservatives especially, not the House-trained Republicans that the left likes, the Mitt Romney-type Republicans. I'm talking about actual conservatives. Very difficult, challenging, treacherous environment. But, you know, that's what makes life interesting. And so the campaign has been quite interesting, and I guarantee you it will continue to be quite interesting right down to November 8th.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Listen up, gun owners. Visa, MasterCard, and American Express are now all on board with changing their categorization, which means categorization for gun and ammo purchases, which means gun and ammo purchases will be marked in a way that makes them stand out from general merchandise purchases, which makes those purchases easier to track. This was done at least in part at the behest of Gabby Giffords and her gun banning group. Kathy Hochul, the gun banning governor of New York for now, was cheerleading this, as were Democrat socialists in New York. This was approved by this organization called the International Organization for Standardization in Geneva, in Switzerland, that sets standards for the payments industry. Stores can use the four-digit merchant category code when processing transactions to indicate what goods and services, such as guns and ammunition, are being sold to customers. This is a way to stop mass shootings, argue the gun banners. the flag unusually large purchases of guns and ammo over a short period of time.
So it was previously under general merchandise, and now they've created these three companies, this new merchant code for guns and ammunition sales. So it's another layer of big government, really. But this is you can make a choice to use Visa or MasterCard or American Express, but without that, what do you have left? Discover?
I'm just trying to think. I mean, it's not big government yet, but the
cards
like but it's
cancel.
the pretext to big government's intervention, isn't it? The NRA saying this is not about tracking or prevention or any virtuous motivation, prevention of mass shootings. It's about creating a national registry of gun owners, which has always been the left's posture. It always will be. That's who they are. Just because they're losing doesn't mean they folded into your viewpoint, doesn't mean they have newfound respect for your individual Second Amendment rights. In point of fact, the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on the topic is one of the reasons that you have people like Kamala Harris saying that the legitimacy of the Supreme Court is in question. It's not just about Dobbs. It's just Dobbs as the latest decision that doesn't meet with their approval. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. So banks are being pressured to not do business with federal firearm license holders, mm-hmm. those in the firearms business. You have on the consumer side being flagged for your purchases. I guess you better pay cash. Pay cash if you want to stay off the grid.
Well, isn't our money our business? I mean, why did they have a right to
track
and see what I'm purchasing?
What did we hear from Chris Whalen yesterday in our conversation, in part of our conversation about the Fed and this new Fed now, where you're going to get through the administrative state, or at least that's the play, to get through the administrative state what they couldn't get through Congress, which is access to your bank accounts and the ability to monitor your bank accounts, transactions above a certain threshold, accounts with balances above a certain threshold. I mean, it's the same thing here. The power to flag suspicious purchases and save lives. That's what the Giffords group tweeted. This will give Visa, MasterCard, and American Express the power to flag suspicious purchases and save lives. So what is the category? Is this like talking about the banning of particular sport rifles? What are the bases for a ban? What characteristics must the weapon have? What are the characteristics that indicate a suspicious purchase? What is a mass purchase? How much? How much ammo? How many weapons? What period of time? What's the evidence that flagging all of these suspicious purchases, however you define that category, what constitutes suspicious? What's the evidence to suggest that it will save lives?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You could also reach out to us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Clay and Wheeling, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Don't worry about it, guys. No gun list has ever been leaked before. Oh, wait, that just happened like 3 months ago in California. Sorry. If you're not buying guns with gold and silver bars, are you really even buying guns? And I say we just make all future purchases look suspicious. Buy 50,000 rounds of ammunition at one time. Don't buy one gun, buy 10 guns. If anything, we're going to need it anyway. If Biden wins again, thanks.
Well, why stop at guns? I mean, we've had a string of stabbings and even a beheading in San Mateo County, California. You know, samurai swords, stop the selling of that. Knives, they're killing people too. I don't know.
The evidence too. I'm funny that way. When I hear policy proposals, I'd like some supporting logic and evidence as to the consequences. What the touted consequences are supposed to be, and then what we believe the consequences actually will be, and to see how close those two are. You know, I like evidence. I like a reasonable, rational basis to do something. Save lives. This will save lives. Explain. And whose business is it going to be? And if it's about saving lives, then that necessarily involves the government, doesn't it? So these purchases will be flagged, and then minders at Visa, MasterCard, and Amex will be in contact with local, state, federal law enforcement. So what's the algorithm that triggers a call to law enforcement to come get me because I went up to Gat Guns and bought a couple of handguns? What is it?
Is it 10 handguns? I mean, what's the red alert button?
Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to something that we do actually have some evidence on, that guns in the possession of the law-abiding, guns in the possession of the oppressed, reduce violence against the law-abiding or the oppressed. This is a fascinating paper that just came out. Clemson University economists Michael Makowski and Patrick Warren, they looked at black firearm access during the Jim Crow era in this country. Their data on lynchings come from a 29 inventory by University of Georgia sociologists. Our sample includes a mean of 2.16 lynching deaths per year, with 41% of state years experiencing at least one black lynching death and a maximum of 13 in Georgia in 1922. Lynching deaths per state capita steadily decreased through a window with upticks in 1919 and 1933. Beginning of end of Prohibition. That's interesting. And I read that not because it's like so meaningful in terms of the top line takeaway, but because this is actual research that was done to try to understand what the implications were of black gun ownership during a period when blacks were oppressed by the government. Black citizens were subject to state and local governments that were rarely better than indifferent to their safety and, at their worst, actively supportive of terrorist violence targeting them, write the Clemson researchers. And this was the context, by the way, in which people like, well, going back, Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Martin Luther King Jr., and others, including Ida B. Wells, argued firearms were a central tool in preventing white supremacist violence against black Americans. Ida B. Wells, she's got a public housing project.
Yeah, I've been there
many
times.
Named after. What an honor. Of the many inhuman outrages of this present year, her writing in 1892, of the many inhuman outrages of this present year, the only case where the proposed lynching did not occur was where the men armed themselves in Jacksonville, Florida, and Paducah, Kentucky, and prevented it. The only times an Afro-American who was assaulted got away has been when he had a gun and used it in self-defense. Ida B. Wells' 1892 pamphlet, Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in All Its Phases. Oh, so we do have some evidence about that. Huh. So they go through this and, you know, construct this understanding of what was happening during the Jim Crow era, do these Clemson researchers. From 1920 to 1940, they write, white firearm access increased substantially alongside a decline in black firearm access. Although policies like increased police employment or the enactment of pistol bans were on their face race neutral, the results show in practice they had the consequence of disarming black residents without having a similar effect on whites. This differential disarmament could go a long way toward explaining the black-white firearm access gap that arose in the Jim Crow South. In states and in years in which black residents had more access to firearms, there were fewer lynchings. In all three estimation strategy variants, the estimated negative effect of black firearm access on lynchings is quite large and statistically significant. In other words, we show that efforts to disarm black residents under Jim Crow were successful. This decline may have had substantial consequences in a world in which the formal institutions of law would not protect black citizens' lives and property. And they find a statistically significant negative relationship between black firearm access and the number of recorded lynchings. In other words, as black firearm access increased, lynchings went down. As it decreased, lynchings went up. Well, now it's not about race. It's just about the law-abiding versus the criminal. As the law-abiding's access to firearms goes up, crimes goes down. As it goes down, violent crime goes up. Pretty straightforward stuff. There's actually evidence to support policies consistent with that foundational belief. And what do we have with respect to credit card companies flagging and big banks closing the accounts of those in the firearm business? No, not much. We have the left congratulating itself endlessly, forever. Well, as one gladiator once said, the time for honoring themselves is almost over. Steve in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, back in the day when I used to duck hunt a lot more, I used to buy a case at the beginning of every season. That's 12 boxes of 24 shotgun shells per box. So I'm sure they've flagged that. And some of the guys I still hunt with, I know they use, you know, charge cards at the beginning of the season, and they still buy cases. So they would be flagged.
Yeah, well, right, thanks for the call. Yeah, we don't know. We don't know because they haven't promulgated any standard with this, the announcement of this wonderful news. Of course they haven't. Yeah, you know, they'll come up with 800, somebody will come up with 800 pages of legalese suggesting a standard that they'll try and advance through Congress that is unintelligible and just arbitrary enough to be subjected to the whims of sort of the combination of corporate America and leftist governments around the country, including in D.C. That's how they work.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy, in our continuing effort to bring you the candidates in the key races, state and federal in Illinois, that you'll find on the November ballot, depending on where you live. Obviously, the statewide's everywhere, but a lot of regional and local races, too. We turn our attention to Illinois 14. This is another pickup opportunity for Republicans in what still looks to be a pretty good Republican year. Lauren Underwood is the incumbent after winning a couple cycles back a seat that had been held by Republicans forever. Now she's the incumbent, and she's facing Scott Grider, who's the Kendall County Board Chairman. He's an attorney, and he's the Republican nominee for Congress in Illinois 14. Scott Grider, G-R-Y-D-E-R, scottgrider.com is the campaign website. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan and Amy. Excited to be here. That was some high energy music to get the day started here at 7:10 in the morning.
That's what we got to do. We got to get people, up and around, get the juices flowing. So, so tell us where the race stands and sort of what's central to the campaign against Underwood at present.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and thanks for having me on this morning. This seat is what they call a majority maker seat, and we have an opportunity for a pickup here that, the Republicans need 4 seats in Congress. And, having somebody from Illinois that's part of a majority on the Republican side, I think is a great opportunity for us. And I was listening to the news cycle here at the top of the hour where they were touting $1.31 down, gas prices are $1.31 down. And it kind of incensed me to hear them claiming that as a victory when it was even, what was it, more than $2, I think, just in the last year and a half ago, less. And this crisis is real. It's not a figment of our imagination. It's not political. What I'm seeing all over the 14th congressional district is the people are hurting. The poor, the middle class, and those on fixed incomes in particular, they're hurting, and they're being hit at the pump. They're being hit at the grocery store. you know, right now kids are just heading back to school. School supplies are up. Everything is up, and you know, wages aren't catching up with it. And that's what people are talking about in this 14th congressional district, and that's why I'm running is to fight for those folks. And I can give you a small example of how it's hit. I visited a manufacturing plant this last week, and everything that they use has gone up in price, and that includes they had to make some wage adjustments for their employees. They have to, you know, they use steel to manufacture the cans that they put tuna in. The tuna, you know, has gone up. The steel prices have gone up. The gas to get the trucks, you know, to and from their facility has gone up. Every single thing has gone up, and some of that is eaten away at their margin, but a lot of that is being passed on to our consumers. And you know, the free money that's kind of flooding the market from Washington, and that Lauren Underwood and Joe Biden have, you know, just continued to do that's really hurting.
Well, cost of school supplies, yes, everything's up, but the test scores for math and reading are the worst they've been in 30 years because of those draconian lockdowns and kids being shut out of schools. Where do you stand on COVID mitigations?
There's a couple of things there. You know, ultimately, it's up to parents. Parents should be allowed to make the best decisions for their children. They're the ones that know what is best for them and for their families. And, you know, there's a lot of unintended, or maybe it was intended, costs that come along with that. And that's the socialization. That's a big thing. You know, it's already difficult to get people to get out and talk to people. I was out walking and knocking on doors yesterday in a neighborhood. And, you know, one of the things that my walking partner and I noticed was that there wasn't a single child that was out there playing. And this was, you know, early, late afternoon. And when we were kids growing up, that's what we did. We socialized. We ran around from morning till night. And you know, that's the cost that we're facing right now is, you know, kind of across the board with education. Parents' voices are being taken away from it. And at the end of the day, you know, it should be up to them. And frankly, I would support vouchers or tax credits as well, so the parents can get the best education possible for their kids.
Well, that's what should be done. Department of Education should just, the entire $40 billion budget should just be turned into scholarships with a couple of administrators to distribute them to, I don't know, supplement any state that has state and local scholarship programs, as far as I'm concerned, because what else is the point? You know, it's the COVID thing seems to me is one of the areas where the Republicans aren't being as aggressive as they should be, generally speaking. I mean, let me give you an example of what I mean. This is Jill Filipovic writing for CNN.com last week. She is like way left. She writes this: whatever one's view on the wisdom of school shutdowns during COVID, it is a dereliction of adult responsibility to suggest the impact of the shutdowns is no biggie. The question is now twofold. What can we learn from the past? How can we move toward a better future for the students we have so badly let down? The first step for progressives must be acknowledging that there is indeed a problem, even if some believe it was born of necessity. The next step is to seize the narrative from Republicans who have grasped it overwhelmingly to their benefit to argue that liberals are eager to alternately indoctrinate your children or shut their schools down. So she recognizes where their vulnerability is. It would be helpful if a lot of Republicans would recognize the same.
I appreciate what you said there at the beginning of that, especially with respect to the Department of Education. It's always baffled me why we're taking our tax dollars, sending them to Washington, D.C., and then sending them from Washington, D.C. back to Springfield, and then from Springfield to our local districts. Why not cut out the middleman or two and send it direct to our schools and really educate our children and not, you know, you take it. Somebody explained to me, you know, a few years ago, you take a dollar, you send it to D.C., it comes back at 70 cents. It comes back from Springfield as 40. You know, why not just send that dollar to our schools here? And you know, that's something that we need to do a way better job on.
Now, suburban mayors are dealing with some people that are coming from Texas, some, you know, illegal immigrants who, I guess they're legal. They have work visas, temporary work visas. How do you feel about what's going on in the border and what Biden is doing to just basically let people come in by the thousands every day? Today they're expecting 5,000.
It's not just suburban mayors. It's something that we're actually talking about. I have a call today with our emergency management in Kendall County to discuss what is what our actions going to be. And I can't blame the governor of Texas for doing what he's doing. You know, they're stressed to the max. They've been asking for help. They've been clamoring for help from the government for years, and nothing has happened. It's in fact it's gotten incrementally worse over the last year and a half, couple of years, it's a real problem that we have to deal with. And so not only is it an issue with respect to what do you do, where do they go, how do they how do we treat them once they're here? But it's a public, really is a public safety, national security issue that we have here as well. Talking about things like green energy and, the Inflation Reduction Act, which I call the Inflation Rising Act, which did absolutely nothing. And they continue to not address these major crises around not just here at the border, but internationally we have crisis. We have the crisis on inflation. We have so many things that we're facing right now, and Washington is just sitting on their hands.
So Lauren Underwood in all this, I mean, your district is mostly an ex-urban district, but nonetheless, it's D+4, at least according to some of the cartographers. What is it that you put to the voters in 14 to say, we got to make a change here? This incumbent is not working because X, and this is what you get. This is Y if you make the change.
This is not a liberal, district. This is not a leftist district, which that's what Lauren Underwood, that's what she has voted for. She's voted with Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden 100% of the time. This district is a hardworking district that, frankly, deserves better, and they need somebody that's going to fight for them, to bring inflation down, to allow, to fight against this wasteful spending that keeps coming from Washington, D.C., and, that Lauren Underwood is right in the center of. And for, the last two terms, she's done a great job of, not saying a whole lot and not doing a whole lot other than, just voting in lockstep with the leftist and socialist agenda. And that's really not what this district's about. It's even in the more urban areas, this district goes from the urban to the agricultural manufacturing, the further west you get in it. And, it doesn't matter where I'm at. People are fed up with, the cost of everything going up. They're fed up with their values being under attack. I spoke to a union group, for example, that said, "Hey, we've got Republican values and Democrat needs," and he was kind of joking around with it. But the next line is, "Hey, our values are under attack, and it's time for us to make change." And that's the overwhelming message that I'm hearing across this district is they want change. They're tired of the same old, same old. They're tired of J.B. Pritzker as well trying to pass down the progressive income tax a few years ago. The Safety Act is something that's coming up quite a bit. I'm out in DeKalb County in Malta, Illinois, where they're asking me about Kim Fox and, how can we let, the criminals go free like they're doing and who's looking out for victims. And there's just so many things here in Illinois that we need to change. And I think we've got a great opportunity to do that here in the Illinois 14th.
Yeah, it's not the whole, it's not Cook County. It's the entire state of Illinois come January 1st. But your opponent or the incumbent, Lauren Underwood, where does she live? And is she out campaigning? And is she done any? I mean, she's been like radio silent for a long time.
Well, we like the fact that she's radio silent on the campaign trail. We don't like the fact that she's radio silent as our representative in Congress. And, I haven't seen her many places, along the campaign trail. And that's kind of been her, the way I've seen it over the last couple of years. I've been the county board chair as long as she's been in Congress. And we've met, one time in person to talk about county business. And, our hope is that we know that we're out working her on the ground. They're going to send a lot of money into this this district just because, Nancy Pelosi is going to want to do that. But, you know, we hope she continues to be MIA on the campaign trail.
Is there something that about Lauren Underwood that people don't know they should know? Is there something that you think sort of defines her essence as a member of Congress, as a legislator, gives us a real insight into who she is, sort of a heuristic, a handle that people can get around her to understand exactly who she is to inform their choice?
There's a couple of things. Something that came up yesterday specifically three different times was the Roe v. Wade decision. And, you know, there were Republicans that were sort of concerned and lamenting it and said, hey, they're beating us over the head with Roe v. Wade. And, you know, what you have to look at with Lauren Underwood is, you know, she's voted for to support abortion at 9 months. She's voted to support abortion at, you know, after birth. And, you know, 80% of Americans at least support some type of limitation on abortion. So the radical is Lauren Underwood in this race. It's not somebody that's pro-life. You know, she's taken on these radical positions, and that's just one. You know, another is with respect to, you know, the fact that she's voting lockstep with Nancy Pelosi. And that's just out of step with his district. She's not coming in and listening to the residents here. You know, Nancy, I'm sorry, Amy, you'd mentioned where does she live?
Yeah, well, where does she live?
You know, a lot of people would say that she lives in you know, Virginia or Maryland or Washington, D.C., because she's not back here in the district a lot. Her residence is in Naperville, you know, barely into the district, you know, just inside the district and over in, you know, Naperville. But, you know,
isn't that her parents' house, though? Doesn't she live with her parents?
Well, I don't know. That's what I have been told. You know, I haven't verified that fact, though.
Still saving up money for her own place. All right, Scott Greider, he's a
Republican. You're wishing reimbursement.
Yeah, right. No, yeah, right. Student loan forgiveness. Maybe that'll help facilitate a home purchase in district. Yeah. Scott Greider, he's the Republican nominee for Congress in Illinois 14, running against Lauren Underwood. He's an attorney. He's also the Kendall County Board Chairman. Scott Greider, G-R-Y-D-E-R, scottgreider.com is the campaign site. Scott, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan, Amy. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you and good luck. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Insert Democrat socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House law for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out. When you're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That theme music means it's time for our weekly conversation with Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. And all good things come to an end. The reign of Mike Madigan, the tenure of Ed Burke. It hasn't yet. It may at some point. The tenure of Ann Burke.
Yes, she is.
Mike Scott's been reporting. Boy, that dynamic duo, that power couple, the alderman and the Supreme Court justice. I mean, if he ever goes to trial, you know, that may come to an end completely.
Longest 4.5 years before he goes to trial. But that's what I was thinking. Her last day is November 30th. Do you think that's why she's retiring before his trial begins?
Is his trial scheduled to begin this decade? I have no idea.
In 2023 at some time.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure I'll get pushed back again for some other reason.
He's into it.
Yeah, but he's running again. He's up for re-election, so you want change. You guys can make change.
Why wouldn't he run for re-election? He won last time under indictment.
Yeah, that's true. With three gates in front of his house.
Well, I'm fascinated to talk to Ted this week because I want to know how the big conference went. So let's get right to it. Ted Dabrowski, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Did you pick up the Troublemakers Union T-shirt I asked you to get at the 2022 Socialism Conference at the Hyatt Regency last week?
I didn't get one.
Oh, All right. Yeah, the you saw that, though. Over Labor Day weekend, you had some 1,700 socialists convene in Chicago. Why would they pick Chicago, I wonder? To 2022 Socialism Conference. You know, and this was great because this was the first in-person gathering of the socialists since 2019, you know, because of COVID.
Well, this is the place to do it, right? Chicago. You know, just look at every policy we're following. I mean, you just go down the list and, yeah, why not meet in Chicago?
Well, so here's the thing. I made this point, and I want to get your reaction to it, earlier this week amid the whole controversy over the migrants being bussed up from Texas to Chicago and then out to the suburbs. The sanctuary city, county, state business, like the Safety Act, this is all about Chicago extending its political culture and pushing its problems to the suburbs and exurbs and to the entire state. Socialism is for sharing. It's what they've always done. It's what they did when they took down the housing projects and pushed Section 8 out into the suburbs and generated this whole affordable housing movement that took hold in these daffy rich leftist enclaves in the suburbs too. It is always them extending the cost of Chicago, the problems and the political culture outside of the corporate boundaries to dominate the state. That's what they're always attempting to do, the Chicago politician.
Well, I can't disagree with you, and you see it across the board. You know, it kind of comes back to the power of the political elite, the ones who have those views and the unions who fund them. And it's a club, and they need everybody to play along because it's expensive. You've got to perpetuate it. And you've seen already in Chicago, people have been leaving. You know, it's been shrinking, and you need money for that. You need political power for that. And you need the right language for that. That's why everything has these funny names, right? Like Safety Act, you know, workers' rights, Inflation Reduction Act. It's all part of a game that it's really hard to keep together. That's why they have to keep spreading. I guess the pitch I'd make on that.
What is the skinny on the Workers Act, and can you tell people what it's really about to remind them? Because we keep seeing these ads of this nurse saying, you know, I want to protect her, this girl's life, but if I say something, I could lose my job.
Yeah, that's all part of the new Workers' Rights Amendment that we talked a little bit about last week. And it's one where, again, the same government wants us to think that we're going to be helping workers when it's really a misnomer. It's really, when you look at it, it's massive tax hikes, fewer parents' rights. And, you know, if you're for this, massive public sector union powers. It's really what it's about. It has nothing to do really with the you know, the average worker's rights. It's the exact opposite of that.
Well, just to develop that a little bit more for those still tuning in and trying to understand this as they're starting to think about the November 8th election and their choices here, the implication of emblazoning this amendment into the state constitution, what it would guarantee and what the implications would be for those who are not members of public sector unions in Illinois.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's fascinating. So to recap, it's what we're going to do in Illinois if voters, because it's going to be on the ballot in November. Most people don't know about it, but this Amendment 1, workers' rights, what they call it, it will cement the already massive powers of the unions, particularly the public sector unions, into the Constitution. And then it says no law shall be passed that reduce, minimize, diminish the collective bargaining and organizing rights of public sector union. And so therefore, it kind of sounds like the pension protection clause, where you can't diminish pensions. Well, here you can't diminish the rights of the public sector unions to negotiate and bargain over a whole host of things, including, quote, their economic welfare and their safety. So what it means is that if this gets into the Constitution, school districts, unions, they can collectively bargain all kinds of stuff, maybe sex ed curriculums, maybe some you know, critical race theory. They can put that into their collective bargaining contracts, and then good luck to parents, you know, parents groups, school administrators, good luck in trying to get that out of a collective bargaining agreement in the future, because the law says that, or the Constitution says that no law shall diminish those collective bargaining rights and powers. So it could spell only, you know, if you look at it, higher and higher taxes, less and less parents' rights, and stronger unions. And, you know, there's a lot of people in Chicago and Illinois that are unfortunately for that, but it's up to the voters to decide which one they want. But it's a pretty extreme constitutional amendment. Nobody has done this in the country. No other state has this level of rights in the Constitution, these level of protections in one shot. So we would be the extreme state in terms of giving public sector unions powers over taxpayers.
Well, that's what it is. Powers. Rights is a misnomer. We shouldn't use that. Rights, you know, it's my right to conscience, my right to speak my mind. You know, rights are some things that exist between all of us equally without imposing a responsibility on me to provide your right to you. This is the exact opposite. This is codifying benefits I negotiate as the ever escalating baseline for the next round of benefits that I negotiate. And the problem is you say, well, they're negotiated. So why not enshrine them in the Constitution and give them that protection? Well, the problem is that it's a false negotiation. And, you know, this is why this is difficult to penetrate, because there's complications to this. You have to spend a little time thinking through this, but the public sector unions, it's not a true management labor negotiation, because the public sector unions are involved in the political process and oftentimes underwriting candidates for office that they turn around and pretend they're negotiating with at the bargaining table.
Yeah, that's precisely true, right? So they're back scratching each other. And not only that, we're one of just 10 states in the country where the public doesn't get to know what was negotiated in the contract until after it's negotiated. So taxpayers, residents, parents, they're not in the negotiations. They find out afterwards. So imagine that, right? They're scratching each other's back in the dark, and we find out after. So and not only that, Dan, but when we talk about rights, and you're absolutely right, you know, what this does is it treats collective bargaining and organizing for the public sector unions just like free speech and just like religion or freedom of press or whatever. It makes it a right in the Bill of Rights of Illinois, which is crazy. But what private sector gets those kind of protections? Private sector worker. So private sector workers are forced to pay for, quote, the rights of the public sector, whether you like it or not, whether you can afford it or not.
And you just understand, like, I'm talking to somebody about the housing market here. Like, it doesn't forget mortgage rates and things like that. I mean, it just makes it worse. But understand, there is no possibility. Oh, that's the hot suburban housing market. There is no possibility to generate a return on your investment in Illinois when it comes to property. There is no possibility. You cannot make the math work. That's just a categorical statement. People that are suggesting they're reaping any significant benefits, I mean, there are, of course, going to be anomalies from, you know, the deal that you got to acquire the land, or it was in your home, your family or whatever. I'm talking about generally speaking, you know, straight up on the open market. The math is impossible, and it is because of the public sector union power. It is because of the confiscatory property tax system that underwrites blank checks to school districts. And it is only going to be exacerbated if that approach to governance is codified, the public sector union dominance is codified in the Constitution. But forget even thinking about return on investment. Think about when it comes to your home or commercial property. It is not possible. Just stop.
Hey, Dan, and Dan, what you're saying is not hyperbole. It's the fact. I'm looking at the U.S. Census Bureau data right in front of me. I've got the last 20 years from 2000 to 2020 with home value growth adjusted for inflation state by state. And you've got some states growing their home values after inflation over these 20 years, 80%, 70%, 60%. You know, you're talking about, you know, Texas and Virginia and Maryland, 50%. Down at the very bottom of the list is Illinois. It's the third worst in the country, up 3%. Your home values on average in Illinois across the last 20 years are up 3%. In other words, zero. So other people are growing their nest eggs dramatically in other states. And in Illinois, you haven't even hung even. You've barely broken even with inflation. And that was during the good times. If we codify something like this in the Constitution, forget it.
What's your handle on the Safety Act? Again, speaking of misnomers, this no cash bail, release violent predators, pending trial, defenestrate police power to arrest and provide public safety. What's your handle on whether or not this is breaking through, and maybe this is something that can stoke that revolt that we've spent so many years lamenting not occurred?
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting. All you have to do is look at the groups that are starting to write. I think Pritzker has recognized, I've got to start defending, and that's why he's had to come out with the racist card. The data's all against him, but the messaging is really against him too. So, he's bringing out, you're starting to see the national publications having to come in and give him cover. And so, I think, some of the stuff you've written, some of the stuff that's been said by Glasgow and Berlin from DuPage and Will, and others. Now that Rockford op-ed is very powerful. At Wire Points, we're going to do our own version of kind of an analysis of the law, because I think that needs to be more clear as to what's happening. So we'll have that out in the next couple of days. But it's clearly gotten them on defense. And, Pritzker's having to come out and defend, and Lightfoot, too. They're having to come out and defend. And of course, like you say, and just like when the CTU called us, F Wire Points the other day,
right,
they're having to resort to name calling because they can't argue on the data. They can't argue on the data. They can't argue on the merits. They can't argue on the law. They're stuck. Now, the question is, can we make it loud enough that those who oppose these failed policies, can we make it loud enough to not only put them on defense, but to make the, let's call it the central left, independent person start to say, what is that noise I hear?
Well, speaking of data, you just, WirePoints tweeted out something that I found fascinating and just kind of said, thank you, Lord, about what Mayor Lightfoot, Governor Pritzker, they're doing now when it comes to our youth and how many have died from homicide versus from COVID since March 2020.
Yeah, we've had almost 200 kids, under the age of 18 since COVID. 200 die from homicide, shootings, knives, whatever you want to call it. It's a phenomenal number. 9 died from COVID, and virtually every one of them had some kind of very serious, underlying factor. So it might be closer to 0, really, who died from COVID. They were obsessed with closing schools. They were obsessed with their COVID policies, but they haven't figured out how to take control of the streets. And so in the meantime, kids are getting killed, random killings now, little kids sitting in cars, sitting in their porches. Most of that is the victims are Black. Then you start taking into account murders. I was just in the 2021 police report for CPD. 80% of all deaths, murders, are Blacks. Mm-hmm. So, Pritzker and Lightfoot, they keep talking about racism and all that. They're not taking care of the victims who are primarily Black. And so when we talk about improving criminal justice, we're talking about improving the safety of Blacks in the South Side, in the West Side, kids. And instead, they're the ones throwing out the racist terms. It's like typical thing. It's upside down. But what I like is that they're on defense because they have no data, no proof, no claims to back up what they say. Whereas we have the data to show the carjackings, one every 5 hours now. You've got, under Pritzker, we have 5 policemen slayed in 2021. That was the 4th highest in the country. Only Florida, Texas, and Georgia were worse than we were. These lax policies are hurting people. The videos you guys have been putting in ads, those are real people being hurt. Doesn't matter what color they are. Doesn't matter where they live. It's happening everywhere. And so I think we just have to keep making the case that this is the failed policies. And, if Chicagoans, Illinoisans want something better, they've got to swap out the leadership or swap out the policies.
Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Long Cold Winter is not just the title of the second studio album from glam metal band Cinderella. It's also, thank you very much, Mike Scott.
That was
impressed.
Really good. I think you've been working on that all morning.
Mike Scott's impressed. Yeah. No, it just came to me, Long Cold Winter, because that's what Europe is in for.
Yeah.
And it won't be as melodic as Cinderella's offering. I love exchanges like this. We just don't get enough of them because people that are talking sense don't get platformed by the left. But this astrophysicist, and if you didn't know he was an astrophysicist, if you took one look at Piers Corbin, the founder of Weather Action, you would know he's an astrophysicist because you would think astrophysicist or 17th century composer, because
okay.
That's the kind of vibe he gives off.
All right.
This is what he had to say on Russia Today about climate change against the backdrop of this climate-induced or climate policy-induced economic crisis in the West.
Russia's deadly wildfires, the smog-filled cities and poor harvest are being seen by some environmentalists as signs of climate change. Let's now cross live to London to discuss this with Piers Corbin. He's an astrophysicist and also founder of Weather Action. Good to have you. Thanks very much indeed for joining us live there in London. So what we are seeing here is a drastic change in climate, aren't we?
Well, climate has always been changing, but this has nothing to do with man. In fact, we predicted that there would be extreme heat in East Europe and Russia this summer. And it's caused by a certain circulation pattern. CO2 does not cause circulation patterns. What causes those is a combination of solar activity and the state of the phases of the moon.
But hang on, Piers. Excuse me, just a minute. You say this isn't caused by man. How come they're reporting this heat wave is recognised as the worst in 1,000 years of recorded history in Russia?
Well, of course,
man has got something to do with this, hasn't he?
No, nothing to do with it. The only connection is man is here at the same time as the sun and the moon are doing things. You see, a very similar situation happened about 132 years ago, where there was the same sun, earth, lunar, magnetic states. There was heat waves in Russia, and there were also floods in Pakistan as now. And in the previous few years, there was also floods in the English summers, also 132 years ago. So these things are dictated by solar activity in the moon. They're nothing to do with mankind, and those who say that are just trying to make money out of carbon.
But are we not going to see this? Are we not going to see this again next year, the year on? I mean, it's quite recent.
Very interesting question. These things do come in bursts, and we're working on that very question, those forecasts. We did say there would be a series of wet summers in England, for example, which we've had. Now, will there be a series of these very hot summers in Russia? We don't know. We have to work on that. But I assure you, it's nothing to do with carbon dioxide. And if you stop driving around Moscow, it won't affect next summer one jot.
Well, how come then so many climate change scientists disagree with you and they get so much support for what they say?
They're on a gravy train, for heaven's sake.
They're on the gravy train, for heaven's sake.
It's a moneymaker, yeah.
Can't you figure it out? Can't you see this for what it is? They're on the gravy train, for heaven's sake, which is why they can create hysteria and implode Western economies incredibly, despite the fact that between 2015 and 2021, China's emissions increased by 11%. U.S. has actually reduced its emissions by 6%. Meanwhile, according to the nonprofit Global Energy Monitor, as of July of this year, China had some 258 coal-fired power stations, proposed, permitted, or under construction. If completed, they would generate more than 60% of the world's total coal capacity under development. Global Energy Monitor also reports that as of July, China had 174 new coal mines or coal mine expansions proposed, permitted, or under construction, that when complete would produce 596 million metric tons per year. China is also investing in hydro, wind, solar. But energy demand continues to grow. Coal accounted for nearly 64%, two-thirds of China's power generation in 2021. As the Wall Street Journal editorial board opines, while the Biden administration does all it can to restrict U.S. fossil fuels, no matter the economic harm, Beijing is charging ahead with coal imports, coal mining, and coal power to become the world's the world's leading economy. They, the Chinese, must marvel at the good fortune in having rivals who are so self-destructive. Indeed. The self-destructive West. There's a book series. They're in there somewhere. James Perry, Senior VP and partner at Arbor Research, joins us now. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. Good morning.
Well, we're seeing the price at the pump decline a bit from the summer highs because of decreased demand. Despite, I guess, according to the president, having zero inflation as of July, the August number says we still have inflation, and it's actually ticked up. So not only was he, you know, misstating the case, obviously, last month with the July number, now we see August increasing over July, the August number, August over August, 8.3%. And so we have not reached peak inflation like many had hoped we had as of July.
That is correct. And that's the message you get from Wall Street every day. JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs and those guys have been talking about peak inflation and that the Fed is correct and transitory wins. And I guess you have to recognize that you have to consider the source. These guys sell risk assets, so that's what they're going to say.
And so that informs what the mystics at the Fed do in 8 days. How? Does that change? We go from 75 basis points to something a bit higher? Do they build in more rate hikes between now and the end of the year? What's the reaction going to be?
Right. To your point, the Fed will hike rates by 75 basis points on the 21st. And they need to do that to show some consistency. If they change things, it'll change. But the market is fully priced in a 75 basis point hike. It's almost 100% as of this number today. And interestingly, about this number today, you know, if you look at the S&P futures before the data this morning, the S&P was in the market, was priced to go up $30 before the number. Now it's down 90, right? So the market is surprised here. I'm not sure why. This is really all about the Fed. The very simple fact is, you know, the Federal Reserve Bank has been responsible for the growth in the stock market and the corporate bond market and the real estate market since the pandemic. The Fed's balance sheet has doubled in size to $9 trillion. That's 40% of GDP. If that didn't happen, the stock market and bond market and the real estate market and all these other leverage markets would not be here. And now, QE, right, is over. And that put downward pressure on rates and increased liquidity. And now QT is going to do the reverse, right? Treasury supply is going to increase and interest rates are going to increase. And the Fed is not the big buyer. Who's going to take the place of the Fed, right? They're not there anymore. It's the hedge funds. They're not there. Banks, they're not there. Who is going to be the buyer and who's going to stop interest rates from going up? So QT, right, is as ambitious as it is uncertain.
Yeah,
and it comes at a time when rates are already rising quickly.
And so what is the market reaction is just going to be to press the advantage when it looks like they're sticking the landing and retrench when it doesn't look like they're sticking the landing and just sort of go back and forth and hope that the net at some indeterminate point next year is that we're back to a low inflationary environment where the Fed can re-ramp up their asset purchases? Is that basically the thinking?
I think that's right. I mean, we've had some bullish moves here through the summer, you know, and I think even the most recent one in the last sort of 4 or 5 days, the S&P is up sort of 250 points since that sort of last Thursday. The dollar went down. That helps the S&P. The S&P 500 gets about 25% of their earnings in Europe, right? So when the dollar is going up, it hurts them. So when the dollar goes down, that has helped. I think there's been a lot of talk about a major pivot point in this war. The Russians are retreating, and Maybe that takes a little pressure off of food and fuel. And maybe that gives you a peak inflationary story. Obviously, that's the hopes and dreams part of the equation. The reality is that, you know, you've got a recession in China. The property market there is imploding. That's going to be worse than the 08, 09 mortgage debacle here. And Europe's in a recession with inflation. UK inflation is supposed to be 22% this year.
Yeah.
Right? So maybe this whole change of the monarchy and all that sort of good feeling has kind of put sort of those things, you know, sort of on the back burner for a while. But the fact is, you're going to have an inflationary recession, a stagflationary recession globally for the first time in history, right? It's in Asia, it's in Europe, it's here, it's South America, it's Africa, it's everywhere.
But people who are living paycheck to paycheck really want to know when it's going to end. I mean, at the grocery store right now, a loaf of bread, this is on sale, $2 for $8.
Well,
right. I mean, granted, it's multi-grain bread, but I mean, every time I go to the store, you don't walk out of there without spending at least $100, you know, to $300.
Yeah, I know. I mean, soaring prices for food and fuel are hitting the poor the hardest and the middle class people the hardest. I mean, it's. I don't see how people can continue to live without just ceasing their spending altogether because the costs are rising. Disposable income at the household level is negative. So savings are down and credit card debt is soaring.
So to Amy's question of when is it going to end, what I hear you saying, and I don't mean to be doomsday about this, but what I hear you saying is in America, it's barely even begun.
Right. Well, you know, the great Milton Friedman once said that inflation is always a monetary phenomenon, and that's been true. And the fact is that what has caused the monetary phenomena is the government. So the government has created this monetary phenomena, and they have piled on top of it a regulatory framework which increases costs at the producer level for food, for example. Every processing plant in the country, cheese, yogurt, bread, packaged meat, anything you can buy is regulated by the government. And those regulations under COVID created a situation where the workforce and the productivity of those places had to be reduced by about 50% because of COVID regulations. They're still in place, right? This is why bread's expensive, Amy. This is why everything you buy at the grocery store is expensive. The producers cannot get those goods to market at the same level that they did 3 years ago. And that's not going to change until the government rolls back regulation. And that includes food and fuel. And just to I know we're short on time here, but, you know, Biden has been saying that the war in Ukraine was the reason there's oil price increases. Well, okay, maybe, but let's be real here. A barrel of oil was $30 when Biden took office, and it was $90 before Russia crossed the Ukrainian border.
Right.
It went up to 130 for a little while, and now it's back down to 90. So the war effect on oil is over. The question is, what are the regulatory authorities at the governmental level doing about $90 a barrel of oil? How do you get it down to 30? Only one way. You have to roll back regulations. You have to roll back regulations on food and fuel.
Yeah, great point. One last question. I saw Goldman Sachs announce layoffs yesterday, which normally is not bad news to me, as not being a fan, particularly big fan of big banks. But in terms of what it perhaps indicates as a canary in the coal mine about burgeoning unemployment, that's the question that I have.
Right. Goldman Sachs, like J.P. Morgan, are the two of the strongest firms in finance in the world. And because it's Goldman Sachs, it's a bellwether and it makes a front page in the newspaper. So for that reason, it's important. I think underlying that issue is the simple fact that investor sentiment is so bearish. Bank of America came out with an investor sentiment survey yesterday. 52% of equity investors are underweight their equity exposure, and 62% are overweight in cash. This is a fundamentally and patently bearish sentiment from the investor base. And I think if Goldman Sachs is kind of the machine that keeps money flowing from savers into
riskier ventures, they recognize that the sentiment level at investors is down, and they've been overstaffed for a while. And I think so is JP Morgan, and so is every bank. The financial services system only works well as long as savings get transferred into people who are borrowers. Yeah. And that is going to slow down.
And so just one other point then on this. Chris Whalen, we talked to yesterday, investment banker out of New York. He mentioned this too, and I think this is sort of an underappreciated aspect of it, but just sort of IPOs all but disappearing, and IPOs as a indicator of dynamism, as you know, of the creative gales of capitalism, to borrow from Schumpeter, and you know, not seeing any activity in that space or very little activity, and what that portends as well.
Right. I mean, you know, when you get Fed policy that is restrictive, you reduce liquidity in the system. When you reduce liquidity in the system, you get higher volatility. When you get higher volatility, that means that investors require a higher risk premium to take on risk assets, right? You're not going to buy Peloton at the price you did 3 years ago, right?
No.
No chance. So the fact is, when you get volatility, when you get liquidity dropping, risk premiums go higher, and investment sentiment toward taking risk is curtailed because their sentiment is, gee, I don't want to put saved money into a risky asset when I might need that saved money to get through this period of high prices for the bread at the grocery store, 2 for $8, you know?
He is James Perry, Senior VP and Partner at Arbor Research. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
You bet, Dan. Thank you very much. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. The Dobbs decision, that's what's propelling Democrats to potentially hold on to their majorities in Congress and to hold on to governors, incumbent governor seats and the like around the country, right? That's what's going to prevent a red wave come November 8th. That's what the D.C. press corps wants you to believe. David Harsanyi, writing over at The Federalist. First of all, Dobbs was worth it. Overturning bad law and the implications of that bad law after 50 years was worth whatever the short-term partisan cost is. That's number one. But in terms of the actual political assessment of what's happening and what's happened since, he writes, the evidence Dobbs has been a critical factor in undermining Republican fortunes is unconvincing. Reuters finds only 8% of Democrats view the end of national abortion rights, quote unquote, as their most important issue. Most other polling comes to similar conclusions. Were any of these people going to vote Republican to begin with? Conservative enthusiasm remains high. Historically, midterms during the first term of a new president are tough on any administration. And despite the White House's risible contention, the economy is humming, few people buy it. A new Maris poll finds 62% of Americans believe we're in a recession, and that's their top concern. And, of course, they're right about that. And then when you start to dig into the issue a little bit, and this is what Republicans who are on offense on the issue, rightly so, smartly so, are doing, as we've talked about here, what's possible in a state like Illinois is not overturning abortion rights or illegal abortion completely. It's doing things that are supported by a majority, supermajority of Illinoisans. For example, Governor Pritzker and Democrats repealed parental notification. Parental notification is popular. They repealed it. Pretty easy to say we will restore it because it's a parental rights issue. Your minor daughter is having or potentially was going to have invasive surgery. mom and dad probably want to know about this.
Yeah, regardless if it's an abortion, any invasive surgery, you have a right as a parent to know about.
Pretty straightforward as our late-term abortion bans. You know, if the real mantra of the pro-choice side from a bygone era is safe, legal, and rare, then late-term abortions is something that generates a lot of support. People are uncomfortable with it. It's not a happy event. It's not something to be celebrated, shouted, if you will. And then the taxpayer funding piece, which, you know, sort of the example of the Hyde Amendment at the federal level, also popular even among people who believe that abortion should be legal in some circumstances. So much of this is a projection of the D.C. political class's views on the topic, number one. And number two, it's trying to paint Republicans who are afraid to talk about it into a corner. And, you know, this is where belief plus courage plus discipline comes into play if you're a candidate for high office. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Professor Charles Camosi. He's a professor of medical humanities at the Creighton University School of Medicine. He's also the author of Losing Our Dignity, How Secularized Medicine is Undermining Fundamental Human Equality. Professor Camosi, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. I just wanted to say I'm a Kenosha boy, so it really warmed my heart to hear all the drive times coming into the city today.
Yeah,
now that I live in New York and New Jersey.
Yeah, there you go.
Still going strong.
They haven't changed much. Yeah, right. Some things don't change. you wrote an op-ed for Fox News posted the other week. If Republicans can't run against Democrats on abortion, they can't run against them on anything. You know, sort of expressing, I think, a frustration that a lot of us feel about just making some of the simple points that I made and that you make in your piece as well. But I'll turn the floor over to you.
Yeah, well, you made a lot of good points. I mean, let's just put the Democratic position here in context. And let me say, I used to be on the board of a group called Democrats for Life, so I actually am sympathetic to that kind of perspective, full disclosure. But let's look at what the Democratic perspective on this has become, and what's one of the reasons I left the board. They are now all in for abortion for any reason all the time. In fact, in their 2016 platform, they insisted that abortion was, quote, core to women's, men's, and young people's health and well-being, end quote. That is just so wildly extreme, it's hard to even put that into context. I tried to in the piece by saying that Gallup consistently finds that, you know, about 8 to 13% of Americans want no restrictions on abortion beyond 24 weeks. And to put that into perspective, the worst approval rating for a president belonged to Harry Truman at 22%. So this is about as unpopular as you can get as a position. And so what we really need is our pro-lifers to be confident and to go into the public sphere knowing that their opposition holds a position that's just wildly unpopular.
Yeah, and yet you see the pro-abortion side, we see it in Illinois, thinking that if they just pound on rape and incest or demagogue the issue of women's rights to control their body being taken away, that's enough to sway enough, I guess, suburban voters to win the day and swing races and at the regional or at the state level in places like Illinois, Pennsylvania, elsewhere.
Yeah, if that's goes unanswered, that will do exactly what they want, I believe. I think it's undeniable. It make a debate about how much the post-Dobbs situation has affected things, but it's undeniable that it's affected it somewhat.
Yeah.
And if you just let them have their way in the public sphere on this, of course those stories are emotionally, attentive to what people think and how they feel. And we need a counter-narrative. First of all, we need a counter-narrative saying that we will always save the life of the mother no matter what. There has [S2] Right. [S1] To be no ambiguity about that at all. And we have to tell the stories of women who survived abortions, for instance, as a public counter narrative. We could tell the stories of children, now grown adults, who have survived abortions after or an abortion rich culture after they were the product of rape themselves. We can talk about the disabled, right, and how they're under extreme threat for abortion. Of somewhere between 70% and 90% of babies diagnosed with Down syndrome in utero are killed via abortion. And how about this one? there's a 50%, I don't know what it is in Chicago, but I imagine it's similar. In New York City, the abortion rate of black babies is 50%. I mean, there is absolutely no one that I've ever talked to, no matter what their position on abortion, thinks that's a good idea. So let's, if you're serious about taking a racial justice lens to this, let's talk about that, a 50% abortion rate for black babies.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, abortions absolutely. Here, speaking of that, in Illinois, I'm just reading the Better Government Association. They did a survey on this in Chicago, outside of St. Louis, there's been a 30% increase. They have, so far this year, 4,000 clients. That's 1,000 more than all of last year. So do you think some of these liberal states are going to try and cash in on this and make some money off of it?
Yeah, that's a whole nother angle to this that's so important, that often those on the left who identify as progressive are all too happy to talk about, right? Who's making money on various things? And it's a good question. Again, I was on the board of Democrats for Life. It's one of the first questions I want to ask is who's making money in any of these situations. But for some reason on abortion, you call it abortion distortion, we don't ask these questions. We don't ask about racial justice. We don't ask about ableism. We don't ask about how this affects women. And we certainly don't ask about who's getting rich by this. And of course, that's obviously something we need to interrogate here as well.
And what's been your reaction to corporate America's reaction to Dobbs and everybody falling all over themselves to talk about how they'll underwrite the travel and lodging of their employees to come to states like Illinois, where it's abortion on demand and taxpayer funded and so on and so forth. That's their way of signaling on the topic.
Yeah, isn't it interesting that they're willing to use this money to pay for people to go kill their children so they can continue to work as they want them to work? But if you ask them, I just saw a CNBC article the other day suggesting that these companies are cutting back from things like paid family leave and other things which help women and families keep their children. How's this for a proposal? How about we demand that these corporations just give their workers the money that they were going to spend on them for them to travel to a different state, right? And say, you can use this however you wish, right? You can use it to travel for an abortion, but you could also use it to pay for childcare or, take a vacation or do something else that would help, make it a genuine choice for people.
Right, but no, we have to signal to the world that we're an ally on this specific issue and only this issue. It's got to be part of the leftist orthodoxy or what's the value in it for, our brand, I guess. I don't know.
You might actually offend people, Dan, who have taken a position where they think that, I got to have my abortion justified. Here's another elephant in the room. The number of people, and let's be honest about this, who had abortions is just extraordinary. And it's hard to talk about this without talking about that. There are so many people, many of whom are hurting and who are deeply wounded by their abortions or abortions close to them. And frankly, we need to do better outreach in reaching out to them as part of this, right? It's got to be reaching out and speaking the truth in love and mercy, not just judgment. But that's got to be a part of any of these discussions here, I think, in my view anyway.
No, I totally agree. I've often said, the pro-life movement needs to think of itself as a hospital to help repair people who have been hurt or are still suffering the consequences of having made that decision, rather than, sitting in judgment, you're a bad person. We don't want to preserve unborn life or protect life from conception to natural death because we're calling anybody a bad person. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do, and we want to help people that maybe made decisions we wouldn't have made, but we're not casting them down into the hellfires as we're sometimes characterized as doing.
Yeah, and if we can save other women and families from that pain, so it's not just about the baby. It, of course, is about the baby, but it's also about saving women and families so they don't have to go through that pain. And I can't imagine being reminded of that now, especially after Dobbs. I think that's where a lot of the anger comes from. People wonder why are, pro-life pregnancy centers and churches being defaced, and why is there this level Well, it's probably complex reasons, but this has got to be a major part of it, right? People are being reminded of this pain in ways they have never been before.
Yeah, the violence piece of it, too, churches and pregnancy centers and so forth, that's really sort of an ugliness that, again, is glossed over by the press corps, almost even rationalized, like we saw a little bit during the riots in 2020.
Right, and the narrative that's left over from the 80s that pro-lifers are somehow the violent ones here has to go away. I mean, if it's going to be a fact-based narrative, anyway, I know those are in short supply these days, but if it's going to be a fact-based narrative, the violence is all coming from one side here. It's not coming from pro-lifers, that's for sure.
He is Professor Charles Camosi, Professor of Medical Humanities at the Creighton University School of Medicine, author of Losing Our Dignity, How Secularized Medicine is Undermining Fundamental Human Equality. Professor Camosi, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.